We might have run amok last weekend with our with our rant about the cormorants and the seals and all the stuff in Puget Sound that, we think might be hindering our steelhead runs in the Puget Sound. We kind of went off a little bit about that last week. But the house biologist, Kurt Kramer, thankfully, he's on our side. He called us up this week and said, hey, guys, here's the deal.
Yeah.
Okay. And we got Kurt on the line right now to straighten us out. How you doing this morning, Kurt?
Good morning, guys. How y'all doing?
We're doing okay. We're doing okay. So I got a chance to talk to you yesterday. I got the chance to talk to Coach Kramer about some of this stuff going on in the North Puget Sound. I mean, our steelhead runs are in the toilet. Not only in the North Puget Sound, but the Green, the Puyallup, all of the Puget Sound steelhead runs are in the toilet. And you have some insight into maybe what might be happening here.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a region-wide, you know, effect. The steelhead and the whole, what they call the Salish Sea, which basically is all of Georgia Strait and North Puget Sound, as you said, has gone completely into the toilet. And, you know, the steelhead spend most of half their life in fresh water and half their life in the ocean. And right now, both places are gone south to big time. You know, over the last 100 years in the freshwater, where our steelhead spent 2 or 3 years, we've continually degraded that habitat to use the productivity of steelhead in our salmon for uses other than fishing or producing fish. That is water, power, agriculture, timber, urban sprawl, et cetera, et cetera. And bottom line is most studies show that our freshwater areas are about 20% of what they historically were in terms of the potential productivity of steelhead. So that's a huge hit. And that's, you know, that's a society choice and it'd be a tough one to deal with. Anything that's happened is, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that you made an interesting point when I talked to you earlier this week, Kurt, in that we have simplified the streams. We've diked, we've taken away all those associated wetlands that are so important to steelhead overwintering and feeding habitat. I just need you to enlarge upon that a little bit, just the basic nuts and bolts of what a productive steelhead stream looks like and how our rivers don't reflect that right now.
Well, steelheads are a really complex animal. I mean, they hatch eggs, so you need good gravel for the eggs to survive. When they first pop out of the gravel, you have a little fish that's approximately an inch long. It needs little microhabitats along the edges and stuff so it can find safe havens and stuff. Then as it grows, it needs a little kind of different habitat. The first winter, it's a little bit larger. It's 2 inches long, something like that, and it needs someplace safe to hide out during the winter. And they do that by hiding in root wads, boulder complexes, little niches here and there, down in the gravel itself. To get out of harm's way, there isn't much food, so they want to get out of the way of predators and floods. Then the second year, they go through the whole same cycle again, but they're bigger, so they need a little bit different habitat. So they need lots of little different pieces of habitat. And as we simplify our rivers, those kinds of habitats disappear. You know, one classic example is the par like to hide in wood and stuff during winter to be safe. Well, in most of our rivers now, that wood is either buried or it's sitting on top of the gravel bars. And so when the fry goes in to hide into those root wads and stuff, that's a nice safe place until the first flood comes. And what happens is that old log floats down the river. And, you know, instead of being a safe haven for the fish, in those circumstances, it becomes a death trap. And that's what we've done to our rivers. And what we needed to do is, if we want to recover some of that, is restore the natural processes that created the rivers initially. And that's a long-term solution and a very, very expensive one. I just read this morning that California is talking about doing something in southern steelhead in Southern California, and they're talking about spending $2.1 billion to have a chance to be successful.
Unbelievable.
Goddamn expensive.
Well, yeah, you know, and I think most people that are close to this issue have a grasp on the habitat side of this. Most people at least have a remote understanding of it. But we're talking about ocean conditions yesterday on the phone, and, I mean, there's a whole different world that goes on out in the ocean that has a huge impact on these fish. You were talking about how our three salt fish maybe aren't surviving like they should be out in the ocean. What's going on out there, man? I mean, that's the other half of this equation that's kind of out of sight, out of mind, that's really impacting our steelhead runs right now, Kurt.
I mean, our steelhead, you know, unlike coho and chinook, steelhead venture clear out to the high sea. Most of our Puget Sound steelhead eventually end up west of the international dateline. They end up much closer to Japan than they do North America. So they spend a lot of time out in the ocean. They really have some pretty specific temperature requirements. They're looking for like 50-degree water or cooler water. They would like to be on the surface. And so when we see ocean conditions like we have now, that's pushed way to the north. And what happens in those conditions is we see very decreased marine survivals. Marine survivals are just a fraction of what they were 20 years ago. What I've noticed is looking at some of the scans of data is the portion of three-year-old three-salt steelhead has declined dramatically. It's approximately half of what it was in the 1980s, early 1990s. And that kind of tells me that even though we're losing fish in Puget Sound, that elevated mortality continues to occur the whole time those fish are out in the ocean. They're going out in the ocean, and they're still dying at a much more accelerated rate than they did 15 or 20 years ago. And of course, that has huge implications on the runs coming back. You've noticed the same thing on repeat spawners, which, you know, as you know, is a cornerstone for population stability. Is instead of seeing 12, 15, 16% of the spawners coming back the following year, we're only seeing 5 or 6%. And that has, you know, the obvious implications as well. So we're looking at, you know, long-term declining marine survivals, and the question gets to be what you do about that.
Well, the other question is, what can we do right now? I mean, what can we do right here, right now, to maybe help these runs recover, Kurt?
Well, I mean, the obvious one is in freshwater habitat. That's a really difficult one. Mm-hmm. One of the things I looked at is, you know, clearly over the eons, steelhead and all the rest of the lines have gone through good times and bad times, yet they're still here. So they must have had some way of getting through those bad times. Well, it turns out when you look at steelhead, they're actually part of the rainbow complex. And you have resident rainbows, and you have seagoing rainbows, and we happen to call those steelhead, but they're really the same fish. And you know, recent studies show that rainbows will produce steelhead smolts. And in fact, in some of our rivers, 20 to 40% of the smolts leaving the basin or the steelhead returning to the basin had a parent that were rainbow trouts. Now, obviously, they don't go to the ocean, so if we can enhance those or protect those, we have, in effect, a population safety net that preserves the genetics of our wild fish that we all care so much about, and have built-in stock ready to jump in and take advantage of the ocean when it improves. There's some flies in that ointment. If you want rainbow trout, you have to really change how we manage our rivers.
Yeah, and that's the rub right there. I mean, we've already, you know, had very, very severe closures on these fish. Of course, we're done at the end of the month, whereas historically we could fish the rivers until May 1st. You know, now they're shutting down March 1st, and that's an issue. One of the issues we haven't really talked about, Kurt, is the bird predation issue. I mean, you know, down on the Columbia, an estimated 22.6 million salmon and smolts were taken from the Columbia River by double-crested cormorants and Arctic terns. And I see on every single estuary, every single body of water here in and around Puget Sound, we see cormorants. And I can't help but wonder what the effect of those huge winged vermin have on our steelhead populations.
I mean, the cormorants are a fascinating bird. They're, you know, obviously a winged predator of the first order. Double-crested cormorant can swallow a 2-pound channel catfish, if you can believe such a thing, even with the spines or erect sticking out of it. That's swallowing your fish with eight-pinning nails sticking out. So they're an amazing critter. In the 80s, we started seeing problems here, and I called every double-crested cormorant in North America and talked to them at length and learned a lot about the biology of the animal. And one of the things that struck me really quickly is, you know, they're a complex animal like all the critters we deal with. And here in Puget Sound, we see just huge numbers of cormorants this time of year, but most of those birds are wintering birds. Double-crested cormorants have nest in the spring, May primarily, which just happens to be the time of year that the smolts are going out to sea. On the Columbia, that's a huge problem because there's a huge nesting colony of double-crested cormorants down there. In Puget Sound, that's not quite so much the case. All these birds that are overwintering here fly back to their nesting grounds, some of which stay in Puget Sound, but the majority of them leave. They go to places like Eastern Washington because they can't feed in Eastern Washington this time of year, and most winters those ponds and lakes they normally feed in have a hard surface on them, so they have a difficult time getting down to the fish at those situations. So we don't have as much of a problem with double-crested cormorants on steelhead smolts because they're not here when that's going on. When they are here, the steelhead are up in the rivers hiding in that overwintering habitat I was just talking about. If we have that good habitat, they're able to hide and avoid those predators. And in fact, if you go up to rock port or concrete or places like that, you don't see double-crested cormorants very often in this time of year. When you'll see them is they, you know, when they used to go up and hang out at the Barnaby Slough and places like that, where you do see them is down in the lower rivers and in Puget Sound and then in the lower lakes, where they eat a wide variety of fishes. I've seen them eat everything from bass to perch to catfish to trout.
And following the hatchery plant truck around.
Yeah.
And
They do that. They have spies. I'm convinced they have spies that live at the hatchery grounds. And the word goes out immediately. 24 hours within the pack planning a lake, there will be hundreds of cormorants on the lake taking advantage of the free meal the state have provided.
Yeah,
on our rivers, this time of year, it's more common to see cormorants eating P-mouth chubs, whitefish, than it is the monitors.
I hear you. He's Kurt Kramer, our house biologist. Kurt, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be checking in with you again soon.
Okay, have a good day, guys.
Thanks, Kurt.